Right, today we're going to take a look at a new data structure. This one is called a priority heap. This is called a priority queue. And a priority queue differs from the first-in, first-out queues that we studied several weeks ago, primarily in the way in which remove operations are done. A remove in a priority queue is done by looking at the priority of elements, whereas in a first-in, first-out queue, removes are done by or in the order in which elements arrived at the queue. Okay. So for priority queues, each element has a priority associated with it. And basically, we distinguish between two types of priority queues. One of these is called a min priority queue. And here, when a remove is done, you remove the element that has the smallest priority. The second kind is called a max priority queue. And here, when you do a remove, you remove the element that has the largest priority. Okay. Otherwise, the two types of priority queues are the same. Let's take a closer look at the definitions of these two types of priority queues. So first, a min priority queue, it's a collection of elements. Each element has a priority or a key associated with it. And then the operations that are supported are is empty, tells you whether or not the priority queue is empty. Size tells you how many elements are presently in the priority queue. Add or put, used to add an element to the priority queue. A get, in the case of a min priority queue, when you do a get, you get the element that has the smallest priority. A remove, and when you do a remove from a min priority queue, it's really a remove min. The item with the smallest priority is taken out. Okay. Right, so these are the operations that are supported by a min priority queue. A max priority queue essentially has the same set of operations, and the differences are really highlighted here in red. The differences are in the get and the remove. When you do a get, the element that is returned is the one with the max priority, and when you do a remove, the element that is removed is the one with the max priority. Okay. Or otherwise, everything else is the same. Now, there are a large number of ways to represent min and max priority queues in an efficient fashion. We're going to be studying just two of these in class this semester. The first one you're going to take a look at is a data structure called a heap, used to represent both min and max priority queues, and another structure called a leftist tree, also used to represent min and max priority queues. What we'll see is that both of these representations for priority queues support the is empty, size, and get operations in order one time. And the put and remove operations take order of log n time when you use either of these two representations. Later, when we get to look at the details of a leftist tree, we'll see that a leftist tree actually supports another operation efficiently, an operation not supported by a heap efficiently, and that's one of combining or melding two priority queues into one. Okay. All right, before we take a look at the heap structure, which is really what we're going to study today, let's take a look at a couple of applications of priority queues. Okay. All right, the first application we're going to look at is to sorting a collection of elements. Okay. So to sort n elements, what we will do is we will use the key of the elements, the sort key. We'll use that as the priority of the element. And our strategy to sort using a priority queue would be to first put the n elements that have to be sorted into a priority queue. Okay. Once we put them there, we will then take them out of the priority queue one at a time. Now, depending upon the kind of priority queue we're using, the elements may come out in sorted order or in reverse of sorted order. So if we use a min priority queue, then when you extract the elements one at a time from the priority queue, the first element to come out will be the one that has the smallest priority or smallest key. The next element will be the one with the next smallest key, and so on. So when a min priority queue is used, the extractions remove the elements in sorted order. On the other hand, if you use a max priority queue, the first element to come out is the one that has the largest key or priority. And then you get the one with the next largest, and so on. So the elements come out in the reverse of sorted order, or they come out in a descending order. Okay. All right, so it doesn't really matter which version of a priority queue you use. In both versions, you can get the elements eventually in sorted order. With the min priority queue, they naturally come out sorted. Otherwise, they come out in the reverse order. Okay. Well, let's take a look at an example. Let's suppose we're going to sort 5 keys, 6, 8, 2, 4, 1. Okay. And let's suppose we're going to use a max priority queue. Okay. So the strategy is first put those 5 elements into the max priority queue, and then do 5 remove max operations. And when we do the remove max operations, the elements are going to come out in reverse of sorted order because we've used a max priority queue. So as they come out, instead of placing them in our sorted array left to right, we'll place them backwards right to left so that you end up with sorted order in the array. Okay. All right, so we start by putting our elements into the priority queue. So we end up with a priority queue that has our 5 elements. And into this red array here, we're going to collect the sorted elements. So initially, this array is empty, and all of our 5 elements are in the max priority queue. You do a remove max, and the element 8 comes out, and we're going to collect it into the right end of the array. Okay. All right, so after you have done one remove max, the largest of your 5 elements is at the right end of the array, and that's where it needs to be when you're done. Okay. Then you do a second remove max, the 6 comes out, and you collect it at the right end, so it comes over here. Okay. Then you do another remove max, the 4 comes out, and it's collected into the right end. The next remove max takes the 2 out, and we're going to collect it at the right end here. And the next remove max takes the 1 out and puts it in here. Okay. All right, so the strategy is you do 5 put operations to get your 5 elements into the max priority queue. Then you do 5 remove maxes, and you take the elements you get from the remove maxes and collect them in from the right end of the array. Okay. All right, the complexity of a sort using this strategy: you need to do n put or add operations. The complexity of one add is log of the number of elements presently in the priority queue. You never have more than n elements in the priority queue at any time. So each put takes at most log n time. Okay. You do n of them, that's n log n for the n puts. Okay. Right. Then you do n remove max operations. The complexity of a remove max is log of the number of elements presently in the priority queue. You never have more than n elements in the priority queue at any time, so none of the remove maxes takes more than log n time. Therefore, all n remove maxes together take order of n log n time. Okay. All right, so you add up the 2, you do the puts, and then you do the removes, and you have a total complexity that's n log n. All right, so using a fairly simple strategy, but a good data structure, namely a priority queue, we are able to perform a sort in n log n time. And that's quite an improvement over what we had with our sort methods of chapter 2. Those ran in n square time. Okay. So by using the right data structure, a priority queue, we can improve the runtime of sort from n square, at least from the sort methods we've seen so far, to n log n. A commonly used sort method that is based on a priority queue goes by the name heap sort. Okay. A heap sort employs a max heap. Again, we're going to look at a heap later today. It employs a max heap, which implements actually a max priority queue. Okay. Now, in a heap sort, instead of starting your priority queue by performing n put operations, we run a different algorithm to initialize the priority queue or heap so that it has our n elements that are to be sorted. And the initialization step actually runs faster than performing n puts, which, as we just saw, take n log n time. And initialize can be done faster. It takes only order n time. So the first step of our priority queue sort can be made faster. Instead of n log n, it can run in order n if you initialize your priority queue using the initialize algorithm for that structure. Okay. Then, of course, you perform n removes as we were doing before, and the n removes take n log n time. So even though one of the steps, the initialization, has run faster, your overall complexity is the same. It's still order of n log n. All right, let's turn our attention now to the second application we want to look at today, second application for priority queue, and that's to machine scheduling. Okay. Let's look at the problem first. Okay. In this problem, we're given m identical machines. So think about a manufacturing shop or a factory of some kind, and perhaps you've got three drill presses there, or maybe you've got five sanding machines or 10 machines that cut. Okay. All right, so we're going to take a look at one class of machines. Maybe you're looking at five drill presses, say. Okay. There are n jobs that have to be performed on these m machines. Okay, so maybe you've got a large number. We got 1,000 jobs where you need to drill holes, and all of those jobs need to go through one of your drill presses. Okay. The problem is to assign the jobs to our machines so that the time at which the last of these jobs finishes is as small as possible. So we want to minimize the finish time of our end jobs. Okay. Let's look at an example which will make these definitions clear. Let's suppose we have three machines and we have seven jobs. And the seven jobs, each of these seven jobs, okay, the first one needs 6 units of time to be done, the second one needs 2, then 3, and the last of these seven jobs takes 14 units of time. Okay. All right, so let's first draw our three machines. That's machine A, machine B, the yellow machine, and then we have a red machine, machine C. Okay. All right, so in our example, we're going to schedule the jobs in the order in which they appear in this job list. Of course, you're not restricted to schedule jobs in that order. You can schedule them any way you like. Okay. And the rule we're going to apply in arriving at our schedule is to schedule a job on a machine on which it will finish as early as possible. Okay. So if I look at the first job, that's job one, it has a time of 6. Doesn't really matter which of the three jobs I schedule it on, it'll finish at time 6. Okay, so right now we're at time 0 out here. Whichever one of these three you put it on, the first job will finish at time 6. Let's say I schedule it on the blue machine so that it finishes at time 6. Okay. All right, the next job in my list needs 2 units of time. If I schedule it on the blue machine, it is going to take 2 more units of time from our present time of 6 when it can start, so it'll finish at time 8. If you put it on the yellow or the red machine, it'll finish at time 2. Okay, so it'll finish earliest if you either put it on the yellow or the red machine. Let's say we put it on the yellow machine here, and it's going to finish at time 2. The next one needs 3 units of time. If you put it on the blue machine, it'll finish at time 9. On the yellow machine, it'll finish at time 5, and on the red machine, it would finish at time 3, so it goes on the red machine. All right, the next one needs 5 units of time. On the blue machine, it finishes at 11, on the yellow at 7, on the red at 8, so according to our rule, it goes on the yellow. Okay, now we have this one needs 10 units. Finishes at 16 on the blue, 17 on the yellow, 13 on the red machine gets it. We have one which needs 7 units of time next. This one becomes a machine is available at time 6, that's available at 7, that's available at 13. And if you want this one to finish as early as possible, you need to schedule it on the machine that becomes available earliest, namely this one becomes available at 6, then you'll finish at time 13. Okay. On any other machine, the yellow and the red, which become available later than 6, we would finish later than 13. Right, the last job is 14. We need to schedule it on the machine on which it'll finish first, which is the same machine as the one that becomes available first right now. And of these three, the one that becomes available first is this yellow machine at time 7. Scheduling it there, we'll finish at time 21. Okay. All right, so the rule is you schedule the jobs in some order. In this case, we schedule them in the order in which they're given to us. When you're assigning a job to a machine, you want to assign it to the machine on which it's going to finish earliest. And that's the same as the machine that is available first. Okay. All right, if I look at the schedule, the finish time is 21. That's when, at time 21, all of our jobs are finished. Okay. Now, the objective of our problem, machine scheduling problem, is to find a schedule that minimizes the finish time. Right. This particular schedule doesn't minimize the finish time. If you think about it, you'll be able to come up with other assignments of jobs to machines so that your finish time is smaller than 21. In fact, we're going to see one such schedule in a moment. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at a different scheduling rule. This one results in schedules called LPT schedules. Okay. So these are longest processing time first schedules. And what that means is we reorder the jobs in descending order of their processing time. Okay. So you take the longest job first, then the next longest, and so on. So after you've reordered the jobs in this order, you then apply the previous scheduling rule, namely assign jobs in the order in the list. When you're assigning a job, put it on the machine that finishes first. Equivalently, that is available first. Okay. All right, so let's run through our example. We've got our blue machine, our yellow machine, and our red machine. Okay. All right, so the first job now is 14. It goes on the blue machine. It finishes at time 14. Then comes 10. It goes on the yellow machine, where it finishes at time 10. Then comes the job whose length is 7. It goes on the red machine, where it finishes at time 7. Then comes job whose length is 6. The first available machine is the red one, so it goes over there. Then you get a job whose length is 5. The first available machine is the yellow one. Then you get a job whose length is 3. The first available machine is the red one. Then finally, you get this job whose length is 2. The first available machine now is the blue one. Okay. And you get a schedule whose finish time is 16, improving our previous schedule by 5 units. Okay. All right, so we now have a better schedule. Now, in this particular case, our schedule is actually optimal. You cannot find a schedule with smaller finish time. It's not too hard to come to that conclusion. We see here that we have only 1 unit of free time left. Okay. Now, if you were to add up the lengths of these jobs, you'd have 16 and 16, 32 and a 47. If you schedule on 3 machines, there's no way to do it in less than 47 over 3, which is like 15.66. Six. Okay. Since the job times are integer, you really aren't going to have a schedule with a non-integer finish time. Okay. So if 15.666 is known to be the best you can do, you have to really go to the next integer to come up with a lower bound on the length of any schedule. So we conclude that 16 actually is the best you can do. Okay. There's really no way to do it in 15. in 15 units of time with three processors, you can only have a total execution time of 45, but you need 47. So you have to go to 16 where you can get 48, and there's nothing in between 15 and 16 as a feasible finish time. Okay. All right, so 16 is the best possible, and an LPT schedule in this case actually gives us the best possible. Okay. Now, you can go home and play around with LPT schedules. You ought to be able to come up with instances, in fact, two machine instances, where LPT schedules are not optimal. Okay. Now, what you can prove is that the ratio in the finish time obtained by our LPT rule and the smallest possible finish time never exceeds 4 over 3. Okay. So actually, LPT schedules, even though they aren't guaranteed to be optimal, they do come fairly close to being the best. They're never more than 33% in length. Okay. And usually, they're much closer than the 33% indicated by this worst-case performance bound over here. Okay. Now, you probably don't want to try and prove this bound at home. It does take a few pages, few type pages of proof to arrive at this thing. So just accept it on faith that the ratio doesn't exceed 4 over 3. Okay. Now, as I just said, often you do get much closer than that. And in the example that we just saw, you actually got to the optimal. Now, when you find that your algorithm doesn't get you the best solution possible, you kind of go back to the drawing board, you think harder about it to see if you can maybe come up with an algorithm that is both, one, efficient in time, and two, does get you the best possible solution. Now, it turns out that the particular problem we're looking at is a member of a class of problems known as NP-hard problems. And NP-hard problems are not expected to admit of a fast solution, where fast solution is interpreted as being an algorithm that runs in polynomial time, say n squared, n cubed, n to the 10, or n to the 100. Okay. All right, so NP-hard problems, this is a class of problems for which no polynomial time algorithms are known. Basically, that means that nobody knows how to solve these in n raised to k for any constant k, so n to the 1,000 or n to the 100 or n to the 2, n to the million, n being the number of elements in the instance you're trying to work with. Unfortunately, there are thousands of real-world problems, problems you really like to solve, which happen to be NP-hard. Nobody knows how to solve them in polynomial time. As I indicated, conventional wisdom is that none of these problems are, in fact, solvable in polynomial time. Okay. Now, polynomial time actually even allows for things with pretty high exponents, like n to the 1,000, as I said. We know from a lecture we had really early in the semester that for large values of n, the only practical algorithms are like n, n square, n cube. Even n to the fourth isn't practical when you get to a large n. Okay. So the chances of finding a practical polynomial time algorithm for an NP-hard problem are much, much smaller than the chances of finding a polynomial time algorithm for NP-hard problems, and we don't really expect to find even impractical polynomial time algorithms for NP-hard problems. All right, so given that expectation, one changes your objective from get me a fast algorithm to find the best schedule to get me a heuristic. Okay. And typically, the kind of heuristic you're looking for is one which gives you solutions that are close to best, just like LPT gives you solutions that are close to best. And it does that in an acceptable amount of time. Okay. All right, so the scheduling problem we're looking at is an NP-hard problem. We don't really expect to find a fast polynomial time, say n square, n cube algorithm for it. We're going to be content with a heuristic which is one, fast, and two, gets us solutions that are close to optimal. So the LPT rule is one such heuristic. Okay. So we're going to be content with that as a way to solve our machine scheduling problem. All right, so let's take a look at the complexity of LPT scheduling. Okay. We need to first sort the jobs into decreasing order of task time, and then we need to assign the jobs to our machines. Okay. So the first of these tasks, sorting into decreasing order of time, takes n log n amount of time, and for that we simply use heap sort or some priority queue-based sort as we just discussed. Later, we'll see better n log n sort methods. Now, once we have the order, then we just schedule them in that order. And to schedule in the order, you need to look at the current job, and you need to assign it to the machine that becomes available first. And for that, you need to find the smallest of the finish times of your m machines. Okay. And a simple way to find the smallest of m finish times would be to compare them, and that would take you order of m amount of time. Okay. So to schedule a job would then take you order m. Okay. You pick up the job in the list, that takes you order 1. You want to find the min of m finish times, that takes you order of m. Okay. So in order of m time, you can schedule one job. You need to schedule n of them, so it takes you order of mn time. Now, if we employ a min priority queue for our second step, we're already using it. Well, actually, we're using a max priority queue in the first step if you're doing a max heap type sort. Now, use a min priority queue in the second step. We can reduce the time for the second step from m times n to log of m times n. And let's see how that works. All right, so we're going to use a min priority queue in which we're going to store the finish times of our m machines. Okay. Initially, all of the finish times are zeros, so we just toss m zeros into it. And of course, associated with each zero, we also keep the index of the machine. Okay, so it's machine 1, machine 2, machine 3, and so on. All right, so to schedule a job, we remove from our min priority queue the machine that has the smallest finish time. Okay, so that's a remove min operation. We schedule the job on that machine, and once you schedule it on that machine, the finish time of that machine increases, and you insert that machine back into the min priority queue with the new key corresponding to the new finish time. Okay, and we're going to repeat this operation now n times. We pull out a job. When you pull out a job, you pull out a machine from the priority queue, you update its finish time, and you put that machine back in. Okay. All right, so we need to initialize the priority queue, so we'll do m puts of zeros. Actually, you'd be able to do it faster than m puts by running the initialize algorithm for the priority queue, we'll see later. But for now, let's assume we just do m puts to initialize. Then for each job, you do a remove min and a put. Okay. Each put and remove min take order of log m time. Okay. So this initialization takes m log m, and then you've got a log m for each job, so that's n log m. Okay. And we assume that the number of jobs is greater than or equal to m, so the n log m dominates the m log m for that initialize. So the overall time becomes n log n to do the sort, and then n log m to do the scheduling. And this is where we are now saving over our previous version. Previous version took nm. It's now n log m. Okay. All right, so that's another application of priority queues. Another one discussed in the book that we're not going to look at here is Huffman codes. They're useful in lossless compression. I mentioned earlier when we looked at LZW compression. All right, with that, let's move on to a heap representation for a priority queue. First, we're going to define a tree called a min tree. Basically, In a min tree, every tree node has a value, a key associated with it. The value in a node is the smallest value in the subtree for which that node is the root. Equivalently, no node has a smaller descendant. Okay. Let's look at an example. All right, as far as a min tree goes, there's no constraint on the structure. It doesn't have to be a binary tree or a ternary tree. Nodes can have any degree. Subtrees are not necessarily ordered. Okay. So you have any underlying tree. The only requirement is on the placement of values. Okay. If you were to put a 2 in the root, no descendant can be smaller than 2. Okay. So possible descendants are 4, 9, 3, or possible children 4, 9, and 3. Again, here, if you look at this node, its descendants cannot be smaller than 4. So here you could have any number greater than or equal to 4. Let's say you have a 4. Here you could have any number greater than or equal to 4. In this case, an 8. This child has to be at least a 3. Okay, in this case, we have a 7. These two children must be at least 7. And in our example, we have a 9 and 9. Okay. All right, so there's no requirement that there's no restriction on the shape of the tree. The only requirement is that no node have a smaller descendant, and therefore the root ends up with the smallest element. Okay. A max tree is very similar, any shape. No node can have a larger descendant, and therefore the root has the largest element. All right, so with that, we can now define what a min heap is. Okay. A min heap is first a complete binary tree, so we're placing a constraint on the structure. In addition to being a complete binary tree, it has to be a min tree. So look at an example. Okay. If you're looking at a min heap that has 9 nodes and therefore 9 elements in it, the structural requirement is it has to be a complete binary tree that has 9 nodes. As we noted earlier in the class, for any given value of n, there is a unique complete binary tree that has n nodes. You get that by starting with a sufficiently large full binary tree, numbering the nodes from 1 through n in the standard fashion, and retaining only those nodes that were numbered 1 through n. The remaining nodes are tossed out. Okay. So the complete binary tree with 9 nodes has precisely this shape. There's no other complete binary tree with 9 nodes in the world. Okay. All right, so once you have the structure down, then you have a constraint on the placement of values. The placement of values should be such that the result is a min tree. Okay. So structurally, it's a complete binary tree with 9 nodes, and then you have the min tree property. No node has a smaller descendant. So that would be a min heap with 9 nodes. Similarly, a max heap with 9 nodes, it has to be a complete binary tree with 9 nodes, and then it must also be a max tree, meaning that no node has a smaller descendant. Okay. Since a heap, whether it's a min or a max heap, is a complete binary tree, the height is log of n plus 1. Okay. Since a heap is a complete binary tree, an efficient way to represent a heap is as a one-dimensional array. You simply number the nodes 1 through n, use the standard mapping. This node is numbered 1, so it goes into position 1 of the array. That node is numbered 2, goes into position 2 of the array. That's node number 3, goes into position 3. And this is, node number 9, goes into position 9 of the array. Okay. All right, so we've seen all this before, mapping complete binary trees into arrays. If you want to move up and down a heap, okay, then keep in mind that even though we're going to continue to see heaps drawn in tree fashion like this, this tree is actually embedded in a one-dimensional array. So if you're sitting at this node and you want to go to its parent, you're at array position 5, you divide by 2. If you're sitting at this node, you want to go to the left child, you're at array position 2, you multiply by 2. You want to get to the right child, you multiply by 2 and add 1. Okay. So we move up and down a heap by performing arithmetic on your present location. Divide by 2 to go to a parent, multiply by 2 to go to a left child, multiply by 2 and add 1 to go to a right child. Let's look at the put operation. So I'm starting with a max heap that has 9 nodes in it. When you put an element in, you're going to have a max heap that has 10 elements. So structurally, you must now have a complete binary tree with 10 nodes, and so it's got to look like this, okay? Which basically means you add a position to the end of your array. Okay. Now, if the element you're going to insert is a 5, okay, then it seems logical that you would try and see whether this is the right, whether you can get away by putting your 5 here, because that spot is part of your heap, but is empty. Okay. Now, to verify if this is okay, we'll compare with the parent. So this is position 10 of the array. I divide by 2, that gets me the parent, position 5 of the array. Now, since the new element is less than or equal to the element in the parent spot, I will not be violating my min tree property. No node will have a larger descendant if you end up putting the 5 here. So I'll just place the 5 over there, and I'm done. Okay. On the other hand, if the new element was 20, if you were to place the 20 here, you would have a problem because the 7 would have a larger descendant. Okay. So you can't place the 20 here. Instead, what we'll do is we'll slide the 7 down and attempt to place the 20 at the new vacant spot, which is the parent of the old spot. Okay. And to see if it's okay to put it here, I will again compare with the parent. Since 20 is bigger than 8, you can't put the 20 here, so I'll slide the 8 down. Okay. Now I'm going to try and see if I can put the 20 at this vacant spot. I don't have to worry about problems with respect to descendants. Descendants on the right are already known to be smaller than 20 because 20 was bigger than 8. Descendants on the left are also known to be smaller than 20 because descendants on the left were previously no larger than the 8. And I've replaced the 8 by a bigger one, and therefore all these descendants are guaranteed to be smaller than the new value that you might potentially put here, the 20. Okay. So I only need to compare with the parent. 20 is bigger than 9, so I slide the 9 down. This becomes my new candidate spot for the 20. I don't have to worry about descendants. I only need to worry about parents. This position doesn't have a parent, so you can put the 20 over there. Let's try another insert. Suppose we want to put in a new item. Your heap size will go from 10 to 11. The complete binary tree has to now look like this. If you're putting in a 15, the strategy is the same. Start with the empty spot. See if you can put it here. So you compare with the parent. It's bigger, so the parent slides down. You compare with that parent. It's bigger, it slides down. You compare with that parent. The 15 is smaller, so you place the 15 here. And in this case, you don't go all the way up. All right. So let's take a look at the complexity of the put operation. Okay. To put a new item, the structural requirement leads you to conclude that the new node or the new structure of the tree is going to require you to have a node out here. Okay. So once you know that, you then start from this position and you walk up the tree. Since the height of the tree is log of n, you'll end up looking at most log n places. So you might first decide, can you put it here so you compare with the parent? That takes you 1 unit of time. Then you're going to ask yourself, can you put the item here? If not, you're going to slide this one down. And then you're going to ask yourself, can we put it here? If not, you're going to slide that one down. Then you're going to come here and ask yourself, can you put it here? And of course, in this case, the answer will be yes. Okay. So you'll end up looking at log n levels of that binary tree. At each level, you do order 1 amount of work for a total of order log n work to perform a put operation. All right, so puts take order log n time. You simply follow a path from a leaf node, from a new leaf node of your binary tree up toward the root. You may or may not go all the way. All right, finally for today, let's take a look at the remove operation. So if you have a max heap, the remove operation would take the max element out. The max element is at the root. So we need to take the 20 out. Okay. Now, once you take the 20 out, the size of our priority queue decreases. Previously, we had 11 elements in it. We've taken one out. You now have 10. So structurally, you have to look like a 10-element complete binary tree. And a 10-element complete binary tree doesn't have this node in it. Okay. So this node has to be removed. Okay. So structurally, our 10-element complete binary tree includes all the nodes shown here except for the yellow one. Now, unfortunately, our red node, which is part of our 10-node complete binary tree, is empty. And this fellow is sitting out, and our job now is to find a home for the 8. So to find a home for the 8, we're going to start at the root. Okay, and put the 8 back into our structure. Okay, so to put the 8 back in, starting from here, I look at the two children of the root, and I find out which one is bigger. It's 15. Since 15 is bigger than 8, I know that if I place the 8 here, the 8 would have at least one descendant that is larger, and that would violate the max tree property. Okay. So you can't put the 8 here. Instead, we slide the 15 up. Okay. Now, since 15 is bigger than, is the larger of the two elements, I know that when I slide the 15 up, it's not going to have a smaller descendant. It doesn't, so it's not going to have a larger descendant. It didn't have a larger descendant on this side to begin with, and being at least as big as the fellow here, it doesn't have a larger descendant on that side. Okay. All right, so this now becomes the candidate spot for the 8. The rule is the same. Find the larger of the up to 2 children you may have, 9. 9 is bigger than 8. You slide the 9 up. This now becomes the candidate spot for the 8. You find the larger of the up to 2 children you have. In this case, it's 7. 7 is smaller than 8. So the 8 gets placed here. Okay. All right, let's look at another remove max. Okay. The max element is always in the root. You take the element out, the size of the heap decreases. You previously had 10 elements, now you have 9. If you have 9, the complete binary tree corresponding to the 9 elements is different from the tree shown here. This node here has to drop out. Okay, so now you get a complete binary tree with 9 nodes, all the nodes shown here other than the yellow one. Our task becomes one of reinserting the 7 that was in that yellow node that got thrown out. We need to put the 7 back into the complete binary tree. Okay. Processes, you start at the top, at the vacant spot. See if this is the appropriate place to put the 7. This is the appropriate place only if, by placing the 7 here, this 7 would not have a larger descendant. So we find the larger of the two children, it's 9. It's bigger than 7. You cannot place the 7 here. If you did, it would have a larger descendant, 9, and possibly others. So you slide the larger child up. And now this becomes your candidate spot for the element you're reinserting, in our case, a 7. Again, you find the larger of the up to 2 children that the red node has. In this case, it's 8. So you slide the 8 up, being bigger than 7. You come down to this red node. You find the larger of the up to 2 children the red node has. This one doesn't have any children. And if you don't have any child, well, then you can put whatever you like over here. In this case, the 7 goes in. Okay. All right, so to perform a remove max operation, the strategy is take out the element that's in the root, take out the element from the last current position in the array, in this case it would be a 1, and then reinsert this element taken out beginning at the top of the tree, the empty spot, the root. To do that replacement, we find the larger of the two children of the present red node. And if that larger fellow is bigger than what you're putting in, you slide it up, and then the red node moves down. And you kind of repeat this operation till you eventually find the proper place to reinsert the item. Okay. To do the reinsertion then, you're going to spend order of one amount of time at this level deciding if this is the proper place. If not, you're going to slide an element up, so all that's order one work. Then you go down one level, because the red node has moved down, and you're going to spend order one amount of time here deciding if this is the proper place. If not, something gets slid up. Okay. And then you come down here at this level and you spend order one time again. Okay. So at each level of the tree, you may spend order one amount of time deciding whether or not that is the proper place to put the item. Since the number of levels is log n, and you spend order one work at each level, you may end up looking at all log n levels. The remove max operation takes order of log n time. Okay. All right, so to summarize, a heap is a complete binary tree that is either a max tree or a min tree, depending upon whether you're representing a max heap or a min heap. Okay. As a result of its being a complete binary tree, its height is logarithmic in the number of elements. When you do an insert, you follow a path from a leaf node toward a root, spending order one amount of time at each level. There are log n levels, so it's order log n time for the insert. To do a remove max, you take an item out of the root. You also take an item out from a leaf node. And then your job becomes one of reinserting the leaf node item into the tree. And now you begin at the top or at the root and work your way down, spending order one amount of time at each level of the tree. So that's also order of log n amount of time. Okay. All right, so a heap lets us do the min priority queue as well as max priority queue operations in order log n time for puts and removes, order one time for size, is empty, and get. Now, in our next lecture, we'll take a look at how we perform an initialize operation on a heap in linear time in the number of elements rather than in n log n if you're trying to initialize it with n elements. Okay, thank you.